From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Robert Kaplan thinks about the world and strategy in terms of geography. Bill Clinton read him on the Balkans in Balkan Ghosts. American generals sing his praises. He's a longtime student of American power. As Donald Trump says, America first, Robert Kaplan is zeroing in again on this country and its fate. This hour, On Point, in our 100-day spotlight, Robert Kaplan on America's geography and maybe America's destiny in the time of Trump and beyond. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Should America still lead? Will America first rally the world? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Robert Kaplan, Senior Fellow at the Center for New American Security, Senior Advisor for the Eurasia Group, and best-selling author of 17 books. He served as a member of the Pentagon's Defense Policy Board from 2009 to 2011. His latest book is Earning the Rockies, How Geography Shapes America's Role in the World. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Robert Kaplan, welcome back to On Point. Wonderful to have you here.
It's a pleasure to be back with you, Tom.
What has brought your globally roving eye back to this country, this continent now?
Because I feel it's necessary for a foreign correspondent every half decade or so to focus on his own country. Because American power has created the post-Cold War or the post-World War II order, the Cold War order, and the post-Cold War order as we know it. And so what I decided to do was to write about my father, who inspired me to travel across the country, to write about Bernard DeVoto, who is a great writer and intellectual in the 1940s and 50s, who's now been forgotten, but I think really understood the secret sauce geographically, geopolitically, to America's role in the world, and then drive across the country and discover things anew and think about America's role in the world in a different way than you can do in Washington, D.C.
I want to get into that road trip with you and your kind of jagged line across the center of the United States from the Northeast all the way down to San Diego, ultimately. And I want to think about, yes, your sort of hero here, Bernard DeVoto. You call him the lyrical historian of westward expansion. But I want to get clear right off the bat how America first fits in or doesn't fit in with your understanding of American power and America's role in the world. We heard it right from the steps of the Capitol in Donald Trump's inauguration speech, front and center. How does it sync or not with the way you see the world and America's role, Robert?
It doesn't in any way comport with America's geographical destiny. When I listened to President Trump give his inaugural address, I said, my word, Charles Lindbergh could have given the same speech almost. Charles Lindbergh being the man who flew solo across the Atlantic, but later became associated with supporting Nazi Germany, with trying to keep America out of World War II, the America First movement being essentially isolationist against any involvement in the conflict in Europe leading up to the Second World War. And what I discovered in American geography was American geography argues for a moderate realist internationalism. It does not argue for America First, neither does it argue for a relentless militant interventionism. It's between the two extremes, and we could get into that, the how and why of that.
So what do you make of now President Trump bringing this as his watchword, his phrase, as he comes into office? I mean, after all, you've got his new defense secretary, General James Mattis, as one of the people giving you a very warm blurb for the book, saying that this book will balance America's idealism and pragmatism in dealing with the changed world. It's a jewel of a book. Earning the Rockies lights the path ahead. He's going to be Donald Trump's Secretary of Defense, but you're comparing this Donald Trump's inauguration message to isolationism out of the 1930s. How do those fit together?
Well, it fits together in this way. Trump is not all of a piece. Not every single decision he makes is bad. And the appointment of General James Mattis as the Secretary of Defense was seen even by liberal elites in Washington as a breath of fresh air, something not terrible, something good, in fact, an inspired choice. I've known Mattis for 13 years. He's a man of impeccable judgment. He has a very internationalist view of the world. He believes in standing up to Russia, etc. And he's not an extremist. He really is a political moderate. What I'm hoping for, and what balanced people in Washington and elsewhere are hoping for, is that Mattis will act as some kind of constraint on Trump. That Mattis represents very much the moderate realist internationalism that I think is the spirit of this book.
But maybe he's just out there running the military to do what Donald Trump wants. You make the argument, essentially, that by virtue of its geography, America is fated to be a global leader. On the other hand, you say Donald Trump is clearly an example of extreme isolationism. I mean, is America supposed to lead? Because you've also said that, if America turns completely inward, the entire world which America has made will crumble. That doesn't sound like American leadership in the offing.
Yes. First of all, we'll have to see with Mattis how long he lasts, whether he resigns out of frustration or is sidelined or something like that. Remember, Mattis is somebody that even had Hillary Clinton been elected president, she might have appointed to a very high role. So he has real bipartisan support. But your question is right. Will he be sidelined? Knowing him, I don't think he will meekly just follow orders that he doesn't believe in.
Paint us a picture of the world in which you see, if I read you correctly, the United States as destined to lead, even though our incoming president, now president, seems to be quite ambivalent about that leadership. And lots of polls would suggest many Americans have become ambivalent about that leadership role as well, if it's going to be expressed as Iraq war or other things that have just felt painful and like the payoff was pretty small.
Yes. I think that while America is separated from the conflicts of Afro-Eurasia because it's a satellite of the great supercontinent in the Eastern Hemisphere, America, in my opinion, has been always fated to lead. First of all, it's not only that we're rich in energy, rich in natural resources. Our very river system, the very capillaries of our rivers, we have more miles of navigable waterways than much of the rest of the world combined. And it all flows into the Mississippi, Missouri, Tennessee, etc. river systems that flow out into the Caribbean and unite us with the great sea lines of communication. So while we're separated from the world, we're integrally connected to it. And that's that ambiguous geographical factor that in my opinion argues for an internationalist approach within reason.
Why does connected necessarily mean leader? Lots of countries have rivers that flow to the sea. Why the U.S. as fated to lead?
Because the United States is in addition to being connected, is protected to a degree from many of the conflicts in the Eastern Hemisphere, and is endowed with not just hydrocarbons but with all sorts of minerals, so that we're the last resource-rich part of the temperate zone to have been settled during and after the European Enlightenment. This geographical bounty, as I argue, gives us global responsibilities.
And when Donald Trump says America first, are you sympathetic to his depiction of the country within that bounty as in trouble and needing to turn inward and to sort of get its own house in order before it says we're not going to go out and tell people what to do anymore? They can follow our example. We're not going to lead in an outward way.
I'm sympathetic in the sense that I know where it comes from. I traveled across America for many weeks in the spring of 2015, about 9 months before the presidential primaries got started. So to me, at that time, Donald Trump was just an obscure real estate developer and failed celebrity. But what I saw outside of the two coasts, outside of the college towns and some dynamic cities like Chicago, Des Moines, Iowa, etc., was a country filled with towns of 20, 30,000 people where the main streets were shelled out, stores were closed. I saw the thing we love to pay lip service to, the American middle class, I saw disappearing before my eyes. There was a smaller group of people who are drifting upward into the global cosmopolitan elite, sipping Chardonnay at expensive West restaurants. And then there were a far larger number of people who were slipping downward from the middle class into working class, almost poverty. So I saw a country in pain, and that's why I'm sympathetic to the forces that propelled Trump into the presidency. But I'm completely unsympathetic with his vision and his tawdry vulgarity, if you will.
His vision. I want to come back and look at that and explore yours more closely. Robert Kaplan is with us. He's author of the new book, Earning the Rockies, How Geography Shapes America's Role in the World. Pete Seeger with America the Beautiful here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
America, America, God shed his grace on thee and crown thy good with brotherhood from sea to shining sea.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about America's role in the world, rooted in its own geography, says my guest today, Robert Kaplan, and destined, he says, to lead. The new book, his, is Earning the Rockies, How Geography Shapes America's Role in the World, and you can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Very, very good book to read. You can join us as well. What do you think? Is there still a kind of manifest destiny for this country that it will or must lead? Is that appealing to you or not? Could we walk away from it, hunker down? Are we walking away from it right now with America first? And if America under Donald Trump steps away from leadership, from the UN, from Europe, more, what does that mean for us? What does it mean for the world? Robert Kaplan joins us from New York, and I want to get in that automobile on that road trip with you, but callers right off the bat from right in the middle of the country, Omaha, Nebraska. Jim is on the line. Jim, you're on the line with Robert Kaplan.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Jim.
Omaha is geographically almost right in the middle of the United States, and we seem to be isolated from a lot of other problems. We weren't really affected much by the housing crisis. Our unemployment rate is really low, and I'm wondering if our isolation is really having those effects, or we're just an outlier. Thanks.
Jim, I don't think Omaha is an outlier. I think it's an example of a very complex divide in the country. The media makes this very brutal divide between red states and blue states. That's not what I saw driving across the country. I saw cities, substantial cities like Omaha, like Des Moines, doing very, very well. And I saw, even in rural western Nebraska, there'd be one restaurant catering to an elite, and then many, many others that were even worse than fast food. So the divide between blue and red, between the globalized part of our citizenry and the non-globalized, between the pro-Trump supporters and the anti-Trump supporters, existed within red states and within blue states. I guess the best way to define it would really be more by county than by state. For instance, Missouri, I believe, went for Trump. But in Kansas City and St. Louis, Hillary Clinton, led. She was the favorite in those cities, but it was many places in between in the more rural part of Missouri that went for Trump.
So sitting in isolated Nebraska, how does Jim fit into your global picture of American leadership? How does Omaha fit into what happens in the Arabian Peninsula, for that matter, the South China Sea?
I think it fits in very closely because the United States was protected by two oceans, by its geography, but it's protected less and less and less because of technology. We know this. So that America gets ensnared and dissolves into the wider world, and parts of America do that very well, or some people do it very well and other people don't do it very well. Even cities like Omaha or Norman, Oklahoma, which is a big university town, have direct links with other countries and continents. I remember back in 1998 for a previous book on America, driving through the Oklahoma Panhandle and meeting farmers who traded with South America, who sold their pork to South America and other countries. So I believe that as globalization takes root, and I believe it will continue, I think this populist surge that's dominated the news the last year or two will be a swan song for nationalism, not a total rebirth of it. As globalization takes root, you're going to see more interconnectivity between big cities in the interior of the United States and cities and countries abroad, even as rural pockets and certain sectors of the population are left behind.
But you're talking about potentially Donald Trump just in 4 years really changing America's position in the world. Not its geographic position, maybe not its super long-term position, but boy, a lot of things can happen in decades.
Yes, it could, certainly. Remember, geography is the starting point for any discussion. And as I always point out, it starts with geography, but it ends with Shakespeare. With individuals, that is, with passions and psychology of particular people. After George W. Bush was elected president, he was supposed to pick Dan Coats as Secretary of Defense, and at the last minute picked Rumsfeld. Mm. So you could see how the whole history of the decade changed because of that one selection. And yes, so you're right. Trump can really change things in 4 years. The European Union, for example, what is it? It's the outgrowth, ultimately, of American power. The United States won World War II. NATO was established, and as an outgrowth of NATO came the Franco-German coal and steel community, and that led on and on into the EU. So the EU is the culmination of American liberal internationalism, and now Trump essentially is in favor of dismantling it.
And on the Asian front, you're talking just 1 week, less than a week in, and already TPP, he's taking it down.
Yes. TPP was the soft power icing on the cake of what was supposed to be President Obama's pivot to the Pacific. That pivot was about, after concluding two Middle East wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, or almost concluding them, America was not going to turn isolationist like after previous wars, President Obama said. It was going to pivot to the Pacific. And that had a military element with more warships in the region in the South and East China Seas. But it ultimately required a trade element to give the United States the further incentive to interlock us with our allies there. It was a kind of liberal economic internationalism, not towards Europe, towards the Pacific. And by eviscerating TPP, Trump has really put a dagger into the heart of our whole Pacific strategy, and it helps China tremendously.
Terry in Brewstertown, Tennessee. Terry, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you, Mr. Kaplan, for this subject. Do you think that the Trump administration in their first 200 days can destroy over 240 years of progress?
No, I don't. I don't believe that he'll do that, but I think he can still do a lot of damage. eviscerating TPP, saying bad words about the European Union, even of NATO. Those are things that have a terrible corrosive effect, because much of American foreign policy is public diplomacy. It's based on statements that come out of the White House in any administration.
I mean, but here's the United States, and by its blessed geographically, as you describe it, wealthy by resources, as we have seen over time. Is it at a moment now where in a single presidential administration, you could see a tip to some other player? China is the one that, of course, comes immediately to mind. What about that seesaw? If the United States pulls back from the world, does China become the successor global leader? Is there necessarily such a thing?
No, I don't think so, Tom, because with all of our economic challenges and social challenges at home, China and Russia have worse economic problems. They have real structural problems in their economies to a degree that we can almost not imagine. I think that the next 10, 20 years in Chinese political history is going to be far more tumultuous and unsettling than the last 20 or 30 years. And the same could be said for Russia. Russia's economy is imploding on a gradual level. Its defense budget went down by 4% last year. It has a declining industrial capacity. And while China is still growing, it's growing at a smaller and a smaller rate. And it's unclear if China can make the reforms necessary to transform its economy.
If Russia's economy is imploding and it's in such bad shape, what do you make of Donald Trump's fondness for at least its leader, Vladimir Putin, who you call a neo-czarist?
Yes. Remember, here's an irony, that the worse the domestic situation becomes in Russia or China, at least in the short run, the more aggressive those regimes will be externally. So it's domestic problems that lead to external aggression, because regimes, authoritarian regimes especially, can retreat to nationalism as a as an internally cohesive force to counteract domestic disturbances. So I think that as Russia's economy gets worse, Putin will become more aggressive in the short run, and Trump has no basis for assuming a rapprochement with Russia. But there are many, many more difficulties with a rapprochement with Russia, if I could continue on that.
Please. I mean, a U.S.-Russia alliance of some kind, he's explicitly talked about, at least when it comes to ISIS.
Yes. Remember, Russia's the only country that can destroy us in 30 minutes because of its nuclear capacity. So in general, in theory, a rapprochement with Russia is a good thing. We should be talking to each other. Here's the problem. Most diplomatic rapprochements that I can imagine would still leave Russia doing the same thing day after day in the Baltic states, in Poland, in Romania, Bulgaria, Ukraine. That is, act by subversion, by
trying to pull them back into its Soviet Union kind of orbit?
Exactly. Run intelligence operations, buy local media through third parties, buy off corrupt politicians, use organized crime in a strategic way in Serbia, in Poland, wherever. These are things that are deniable publicly and yet occur subtly behind the scenes, and there is no way that any diplomatic deal with Russia is going to stop Russia doing that, because that's the way the regime operates.
Do you see Russian subversion, if that's the right word, in the recent American election season?
All I know is what I've read, and I think what I've read is somewhat substantial, that Russia is clearly using cyber warfare, including hacking, including selective leaks, to undermine one candidate and thus indirectly or directly to help the other. Remember that cyber warfare is something that Russia could do well because it doesn't require a lot of money compared to other spheres of warfare. It's low budget compared to almost any other sphere of warfare you can think of.
Robert Kaplan is thinking about the United States' place in the world as he looks at its unique geography. His new book is Earning the Rockies, a big geographic take, but it goes right into all American international relations and right into the heart of this country's domestic politics as well. Alicia is calling from Indianapolis, Indiana. Alicia, you're on the air with Robert Kaplan.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yes, what's on your mind?
So having just returned from the Women's March in D.C., which was an amazing experience, knowing there's so many like myself who are very concerned and frightened by Donald Trump and what he's doing, where he's headed, my question for Robert is there, do you ever see any chance that this could turn to such an uprising that we end up at a civil war again with those against Trump's policies battling against those who are for his policies?
I cannot foresee any violence, or there could be scattered small-scale violence that the media will play up for sure. We've seen a little bit of that. What I can see is the divide getting greater and greater because, for instance, dismantling TPP, other trade agreements, undermining NAFTA, verbally undermining NATO and the European Union, building a wall, all these things enrage people like you and me, Alicia. But on the other hand, they may be very popular among the part of the population that voted for Trump. So while the first week or so of the new White House has been in a way, a freak show, that may not be how it's being perceived in many parts of the country.
But that doesn't really get to Alicia's question. I mean, you write sympathetically in a way. You say Trump represents a kind of anti-politics, a primal scream against the political elite for not connecting with people on the ground and for insufficiently improving their lives. You write people trapped in their own worries as life becomes ever more complex are simply alienated, and that alienation is registered in a taste for populist politics, maybe even isolationism. But you also say that if we get more disconnected from our kind of roots, territorial roots, the more urbanized and globalized we become, the greater the danger of artificially reconstructing American identity in a more severe and ideological form so that we risk radicalization at home. How does that avoid? So, I mean,
it seems like a contradiction, but it's not. I mean, what I'm trying to do in this book is point out a lot of subtleties and a lot of opposites that in some way go together. I think the thing I'm most worried about is not a clash of civilizations, but a clash of artificially reconstructed civilizations. What that means is that Before the information age, before the post-industrial age, people were rooted in geography, in place. Yes, they had ethnic and tribal differences and political differences, but they lived traditional lives, and that. But now, as traditional lives get uprooted, there's a tendency for people to rediscover their identities, whatever they may be, in a more abstract, severe, and ideological formation.
I want to come back and look at Alicia's question, how this gets resolved, America's role in the world, its implications for America at home. Robert Kaplan's new book is Earning the Rockies. Here's Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings with This Land Is Your Land. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. You know, this land is your land. This land is my land. Oh, this land is your land. Ooh, you got to believe that. Oh, it's my land. Oh, this land will make for you and me. Yeah. Oh, this land will make for you.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron, knowing that incredible ingredients make incredible meals. They follow the highest quality standards and deliver recipes along with just the right amount of ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. New recipes are created each week, so you can customize your recipes each week. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/onpoint. You don't have to spend time at the grocery store. Make great meals in under 40 minutes. There's no commitment, so pick what you want at blueapron.com/onpoint.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about America's role in the world, rooted in its own geography, says my guest today, Robert Kaplan, and destined, he says, to lead. But he's got a sharp eye out right now on the new president, Donald Trump, and how his view of the world may impact that American role. His new book is Earning the Rockies, How Geography Shapes America's Role in the World. It's a road trip right across the United States combined with a deep meditation on the implications of that geography and everything that's grown out of it for America's role in the world. Joins us today from New York. You can join us as well. If President Trump puts America first, will the world see us as second fiddle, not the leader? Are you okay with that? And if we're not out there espousing American values, President Trump says maybe that's not our job, democracy, justice, freedom, truth. What happens to those values globally? Is that on your mind these days or not? Robert Kaplan, I very much enjoyed your descriptions coming across the Midwest and Illinois, my home turf, very much my home turf. You say where the prairie truly begins, the earth flattens out entirely. Black earth, that's exactly where I came up on the farm there, reminding you, you say, just how wealthy this country is, because this production and fecundity go on for hundreds and hundreds of miles north and south and east and west, constitutes the basis of continental wealth that in turn permits an approach to the world so ambitious that the human and material costs are easily absorbed. I don't know if everybody would agree with that right now. You say it is these Illinois cornfields that ultimately allow elites in Washington to contemplate action even as others may suffer or be sustained by the consequences. And of course, that is often meant global action. Lots of listeners writing in. Here's on Twitter for you. Just Jed says, having traveled extensively, and he's writing to you here, Robert, every country in the world puts its own citizens first. Who would elect someone to do otherwise?
My answer, Jed, is this. It's that, of course, you put your own citizens first. Therefore, you don't have to proclaim it as the centerpiece of your grand strategy for the next four years. If it's already assumed by proclaiming it means you have ulterior motives. Many years ago, I met with Simon Wiesenthal, who is the Holocaust. He was the Nazi hunter in Vienna in Austria. And Austria was a democracy. And there was this very right-wing party called the Freedom Party. And Wiesenthal told me, he said, we already have freedom. So any party that has freedom in its title has something else in mind. And that's what I would say. America First is a slogan that harks back to a specific ideology of isolationism in the 1930s.
And what's the implication if people then are looking for a grand motivation? What
the implication, Tom, is that we will turn inward, that we will not fulfill our responsibilities abroad. And our responsibilities abroad can be debated. Many people can feel we went too far in both Iraq and Afghanistan. But generally, there is a consensus among moderate people, I would argue, that supporting Europe militarily, economically, diplomatically, supporting our allies in Asia in the same fashion are generally in American interest. And to withdraw from those responsibilities constitutes an inward turning that would be irresponsible.
Let's go to West Virginia, Hedgesville, and David. David, thank you for calling. You're on the air with Robert Kaplan.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Robert.
Hi.
My point I'd like to make is I think America should concentrate on this hemisphere, as Monroe said, the Monroe Doctrine, and only help in Europe through NATO and leave the Middle East and Africa to the colonial powers that made the mess in the first place. In other words, it's not our job. We'll help through NATO, but the only thing out of our hemisphere we should worry about is strategic safety of the world.
Well, here's what I would say to that. Of course, our hemisphere matters enormously. Just look at the trade we do, not only with Mexico, but with Colombia, Brazil, Canada, so many other countries. The Middle East and Africa, however, are essential to us in this way. While we become more and more energy independent, we still get a significant portion of our energy, not only from the Middle East, but from African countries as well, located along the Gulf of Guinea. And more importantly, our Navy protects access to this natural gas and oil in the Middle East and Africa for our allies, so that we do have equities in this region, in addition to that of just promoting where we can, without being too militarily aggressive, civil society writ large around the world.
What about the notion, and we've got listeners writing in about this, that America, some see it as needing to be out there because of American values, to stand up for democracy and more. Donald Trump seems to be saying, look, let other countries worry about this. It's not our job to go out and do that.
This has been an eternal debate going on in our country, Tom, since John Quincy Adams said that America does not go out in the world in search of monsters to destroy. But in an interconnected world that is far more connected than anything John Quincy Adams could have imagined, we have gone out and engaged with monsters in any case, in the First World War, the Second World War, etc. And but I don't believe in promoting democracy too legalistically. What that means is there are a fair number of regimes around the world which are technically autocratic but promote liberal values, such as Oman, Morocco, Jordan, etc. And so the way we should think about it is the United States, within reason, promotes the extension of civil society everywhere.
Is that a value-free thing? Civil society is an awfully broad term.
No, I think it means specific things: protection of minority rights, a predictable tax system, protection of human rights. Basically, regimes that do not oppress their people, given the history of that specific country. We know, for instance, that Oman has a very liberal regime that promotes human rights, protects the environment, particularly promotes women's rights, and yet it is an autocracy. We're not going to topple the autocracy. That would be irresponsible and may lead to something worse. But we count it as an ally because even though it doesn't have our system, it has our values consistent with Oman's own historical experience.
President Trump seems to be suggesting that what's important now is restoring American power. Never mind everything else almost, put everything else aside. Just make the country rich and powerful again and then turn around and see how that works out. What do you think of that as a strategy?
Well, I think, first of all, we already have a 300-warship Navy. Our Coast Guard would count as the 12th largest Navy in the world. We have Air Force bases almost everywhere in the world. We have a standing army of several hundred thousand. By any measure, we're more militarily involved around the world, under President Obama, a liberal Democratic president, than almost any empire in the past. So it's unclear what he means about restoring American power. America already is very powerful, and power is not just military. It's diplomatic, it's economic, and if you don't engage in responsible public diplomacy, if you try to undermine trade agreements that benefit us and our allies, that is not really restoring American power.
Vinette in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Vinette, you're on with Robert Kaplan in New York.
Hi, Tom, and hi, Robert. How are you?
Very well.
I'm calling because I am very disturbed by this presidency. You know, I think that in his own personal life, he's a very myopic guy. He focuses on just the family and what he can make do for the family and how he can. And I think he's brought that, you know, into the presidency. And I think that's going to be dangerous for our country. And the other thing what Robert was mentioning earlier about, you know, when someone has, you know, says something and then it's really another meaning there. And I worry about a phrase that he used during the campaign about a Trojan horse that, you know, Hillary Clinton would have been a Trojan horse if we ever elected her and that she would start World War III. And I'm wondering, a lot of the things that he says and he projects onto other people, it seems as though really are those things that really is him, you know, that he's talking about. And that's one thing that I'm really, really concerned about. And I haven't heard anybody in the press talk about that. And the fact that he's so, how much has he traveled? It seems as though his only travel has maybe been to Russia, and he seemed quite enamored by the way Putin rules, and maybe that's what he wants to do. So now he's starting to shut down the EPA and all the other, you know, departments that is good for America, you know, the Americans, as far as our health is concerned, not breathing, you know, bad air and having water that is, you know, drinkable. And I don't know where we are going from here.
Vinette, I appreciate your call. Robert, you can hear an awful lot of unease there across a lot of fronts.
Yes, certainly. First of all, I would describe Donald Trump as our first post-literate a digital age president who's made an end run around literacy. He doesn't read books, for instance, and it's only by reading books that you know about America's historic obligations to our set, to our own sectors of our own population, to our allies, you know, stemming out of wars, etc. I also think, as Vinette said at the very beginning, that certainly his statements have had a very corrosive effect on the public debate. He operates almost in a pre-modern style where there's no distinction between family and work, where, you know, where his, the way he's operating the White House is almost an extension of his family. Remember, the American system is great because it has worked on impersonal rules and process, so that you can attack or criticize your opponent's policies or views, but you don't attack their motives. You don't ascribe bad things to their character. You just have a debate over the views. But Donald Trump seems to be all about motive.
We have news today that the Mexican president, Enrique Peña Nieto, is announcing on Twitter that he will not come to Washington, D.C. after all next week. Donald Trump, the president of the United States, had tweeted earlier in the day that if he doesn't want to pay for the wall, he shouldn't come, and apparently now he's not. What about this relationship and the tangle that's suddenly in here, Robert?
Yeah, this is really awful news. Remember, it's been traditional for presidents going back as long as I can remember that the first two or three meetings they have with foreign leaders are with the leaders of Mexico and Canada. So this is almost a longstanding tradition because Mexico and Canada are ultimately the most important countries for us because they're our neighbors. Mexico's population is more than a third of that of the United States. You know, it's a third of that of the United States. It's a younger population. It's a very dynamic, developing society that's beyond the third world, where its economy has been growing at more or less at a faster rate than ours the last few years. That's why immigration from Mexico to the U.S. has actually slowed up, though you don't read about that with all the accusations being made.
So what's it mean or matter if that relationship chills?
What happens is that would make the border more insecure because there is a lot the Mexican government can do to stop illegal crossings. You know, there's a lot of way. Also, we have a deeply entrenched a very complex relationship between our law enforcement agencies and the Mexican law enforcement agencies in terms of combating drug gangs in, you know, in the part of Mexico closest to the Texas
and still we've had a lot of drugs coming in. It's not as though
We do. You know, it's a difficult problem, but the progress we've made has been because of cooperation. And if this cooperation goes south because there's a diplomatic chill, that is only going to make the challenge of illegal drugs even greater.
You've got people thinking about peace and harmony abroad and at home. You write late in the book, Earning the Rockies, only by avoiding self-inflicted catastrophes and joining spiritually with other peoples and nations can we keep the home front at peace with itself. What's the connection?
The connection is we have to make sure not to get bogged down into quagmires like we did in Iraq, and to a certain extent, as we've done in Afghanistan, because if we do, the home front will rebel. Because the only place we can afford to really get bogged down in and keep working on whatever the challenges are the places that I've seen across the continent, like Wheeling, West Virginia, Portsmouth, Ohio, etc., middle-sized towns of 20, 30,000 that really need a lot of help. That's where we can get bogged down in. But we have to keep a light and subtle footprint in the Middle East and to stay closely connected with Europe and Asia.
And joining spiritually with other peoples and nations is essential to home front peace. How so?
Because by joining spiritually, I mean that globalization, I believe, is inexorable despite the recent upsurge of populism. That we're closer, we're closer in terms of information culturally with people in Africa, people in India, than we've ever been. And this is only going to increase. There are going to be more and more Americans of exotic parentages with exotic lifestyles, family connections, etc. So we can't isolate ourselves from the world. We have to embrace the world, and that in turn will lead to a more peaceful domestic situation.
I don't know. Are we off that path right now under the new president?
I think we're very much in danger of getting off that path.
Robert Kaplan goes out into the heart of this country and looks out into all the rest of the world. The new book is Earning the Rockies, How Geography Shapes America's Role in the World. Robert Kaplan, it's always great talking with you, and we appreciate your spending some time with us today. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.